Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is James Golden, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly of The Rush Limbaugh Show, and he is out with a brand new book, Rush on the Radio, a tribute from his sidekick for 30 years. The book is available everywhere, and it's just a fantastic story of not only James's life, but his life with Rush, and a lot about Rush's life in there. James, I loved reading a lot about the insider things, but you were there at the beginning for The Rush Limbaugh Show. How was the format of the show when you first started with it different than opposed to, say, the last 10 years on the air?
Well, the format was the same. The issues started to change a little bit, a lot, actually after the Clinton presidency. You know, before then, the show was a lot more lighthearted, and we used to do a lot more fun updates. It focused on a lot of cultural things. We did politics. But after the Clinton presidency and going into the Clinton presidency, things got increasingly more political, increasingly more partisan. Of course, you might remember that it was during the Clinton presidency that Bill Clinton tried to blame the Oklahoma City bombing on Rush and talk radio. And things just continued to escalate from there. We have been in the midst of it. Everything is political now. I think that trend, we started to see it moving that way shortly after Bill Clinton took office.
When you started with Rush, were you the one that, was Rush your direct supervisor? Who were you answering to at the beginning?
I was working with WABC, and the arrangement was that WABC would provide Rush with a call screener and an engineer. But shortly after that, I left WABC and began working for Rush. Rush hired me from WABC.
So as it shifted to the Rush Limbaugh Show as an entity, at some point it broke away from being a WABC property. So how did that work?
It was never a WABC property. It was always, Rush's company was held by four business partners, Rush and three other partners, and they syndicated. ABC was the flagship station in New York affiliate, but ABC did not own the Limbaugh Show at any time.
Okay, so when I would listen to the show, it always sounded like a loose conversation that Rush was having with the audience and callers, but I think that's a trick because that show had to be meticulously planned. So how would that work when you plan out a show?
Rush never planned out his shows. They were all spontaneous. What you heard, that light conversation, that conversational style, all of that, that was just Rush. He would sometimes even say that moments before the show, he had no idea where he was going to start that day. You know, this was just a man that did an incredible amount of show prep, incredible amount of research, and every day without fail. And so he came to the show, some would say over-prepared, but he could converse on anything that was in the public arena of news. He was full up to speed on culture, and he had his own interest, which he also brought to the show. He had the unique ability, Rush did, to make anything that he was interesting sound interesting for the audience. He was just an amazing communicator, one of a kind.
I learned a lot about your background in music with this book, and can you tell me how that transpired and how your music career, I mean, it never really took off, but it was something that you actually did. You were playing a lot of gigs.
Yeah, well, I was a young musician, and I had to make a choice. Was I going to be a musician or a broadcaster? I walked into a radio station when I was 14 and fell in love. My cousin was a disc jockey, a very successful disc jockey and television personality in New York. But I loved music, and I played with some people now that are at the top of the industry in music, internationally renowned. I decided I wasn't going to spend the 8 to 12 hours a day practicing that you needed to become great, and I wasn't going to settle for being mediocre. I still have had success in it. I'm a published songwriter with BMI, and I've had some other things going musically, but my first love turned out to be broadcasting, and so I pursued it with everything that I had.
You talk in the book about the caricature of Rush Limbaugh. Rush had a caricature that people believe before they get to know him or before they listen to him. And a lot of people, especially a lot of politicians, have that. And you talk about two stories in the book, particularly that involve President Joe Biden and Secretary Hillary Clinton and your interactions with them. Can you share those stories? Because I think they're very informative.
Well, what I've learned over the years is no matter who you are, whether you're on the right or the left, once you reach a certain level of fame, you become a caricature. You are no longer yourself. You are how this media frames you. I believed the hype about Hillary, that she couldn't speak publicly, that she was an ice queen, and all the rest of it. I happened to be in Washington, D.C., and was at a speech that she delivered. You know what? It was a really good speech. At the same time, there were some young women trying to get her attention. She didn't see them. She happened to pass by me, and I told her, Mrs. Clinton, you know, these young girls want to speak with you. She went over, she spoke with them, and then she circled back to thank me. Now, she had no idea who I was, that I worked for the Rush Limbaugh Show. She was a warm, engaging personality. That blew my mind, because I had, you know, just been believing the opposite. Joe Biden, I used to run into at the Capitol every time. Now, I'm not saying any of these people are not who we think they are in terms of the level of corruption, their politics, or anything else. Joe Biden, the only one consistently, you pass him in the hall, he'd speak to you. He was a friendly human being. The caricatures that we develop of people, just like liberals think Rush is some evil person or whatever, these caricatures that the media makes up about almost everybody are always going to be wrong. There's always going to be more to the person than we think they are from their media caricatures. And I have learned that as a result of personal interaction with people.
I'm chatting with James Golden, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly, about his brand new book, Rush on the Radio, a tribute from his sidekick for 30 years. You heard Rush talk about Bo Snerdly quite a bit on this radio station as a longtime affiliate of the Rush Show. But, James, you get into quite a bit of your politics in the book, and you explain a lot of your political philosophy. You wrote a line which I've now quoted to several people after reading it. It says, "While we were out buying guns and ammo, the leftists were buying the megabytes." Can you give me some context for that line?
Exactly right. We're so concerned about the Second Amendment and our constitutional rights with that. And so, yeah, you look at gun sales, record high, but look at where our freedoms are being stolen. Our freedoms are being stolen digitally. You've got social media platforms basically in a position where they can censor not just individuals, they can censor conservative publications. For goodness sake, they censored the President of the United States, Donald Trump. They own the data centers. You saw what happened the other day when Amazon's web service went down. It made a mess of things all around the country. We were out focused on our issues. They were focused on owning the technology that we communicate with, that our economy is now shifting to, which is a digital economy. They were buying the megabytes while we were buying the guns and ammo.
Did you notice any change in how Rush's caricature or how he was perceived or treated in the media or by the left after the show became a video format when you could see it? Because, and I'm thinking specifically back to the Michael J. Fox thing where Rush took a ton of crap about his description of Michael J. Fox on a PSA. And I was convinced that if there was no video of that, nobody would have even thought twice about it. They would have just, the left would have left it alone. But it showed him moving around there. When a radio show becomes a video format, what kind of things do you have to think about?
Well, those are the kind of things you have to think about. How someone's going to take a second of what you're doing and loop it and play the loop to make their own story, because our eyes, believe it or not, can deceive us into thinking that we're seeing things that weren't actually happened. And that Michael J. Fox incident was a perfect example. People tend to forget. Why was Michael J. Fox doing the advertisement? It was an advertisement that was anti-Michael Steele at that point, and And by the way, it was accusing Republicans of some pretty vicious things. Rush's point in all of that was that nobody should be held in such sacred territory politically that when they attack you politically, you can't attack them back. He did a movement to show that Michael J. Fox, the Parkinson's disease, had affected him, and that was part of the ad. That was part of what they were using to exploit his condition. And that was totally taken out of context and looped 1 second, 1 or 2 seconds, looped over and over again, and then a narrative was placed that Rush was mocking him when he was never mocking him. It was a discussion of issues. But when you have video, it is just another element that you have to be concerned with. Any talk show host has to be, and you know this, we have to really be careful about what it is we say. I'm not saying we self-censor, but we should and be responsible and think about how is what we are saying going to be perceived, and if there's a possibility that it will be misperceived, find another way to say it. Well, the same thing applies to video. When you add a video element to a show, you just have one more element now that you need to be concerned about, the perception that is going to be created by your movements, by graphics, or by anything else that the audience can now see.
The show had so many guest hosts over the years, and I love that you put them in the book because I'd frankly forgotten about quite a few of them. Bob Dornan always sticks out, but Chris Matthews told me in the 90s how much he enjoyed the experience of hosting the Rush show, and you didn't say a lot about him in the book other than to blame the idea on the late, great Kit Carson. What happened with the Matthews co-host thing?
It worked out. It was fine at the time because at the time, Chris Matthews was right of center. He wasn't some leftist wacko. But after he turned, I just had fun. You know, Kit and I were so close, but we rubbed each other all the time in terms of just joking about things with each other. And so that was the thing that I used to rub it in with him about. Yeah, well, you're the guy that brought us Chris Matthews. And it was pretty funny, actually.
You did a great podcast series. I think it was a 10-part series that I listened to. It came out this summer. And can you tell people what you accomplished with that? Because if they haven't listened to it, I wish they would.
Yeah, it was Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. And what we did was go back and construct Rush's biography as best we could. We also talked to some of his friends, some of his coworkers, some of the people behind the scenes at EIB, so that we could have an accurate legacy of who Rush was. And it was a lot of work. I had two great producers working with me on that, Chris Kelly and Phil Tower. And it was just an amazing production from the standpoint of the way that it came out. It was, I couldn't ask for better. And it got a really good reception from those people that took the time to find the podcast. It is available on iHeart and most other places that you can download podcasts.
And you also have a show now with WABC. Where can people tune in? What are they can expect with that?
6 days a week. I'm doing afternoons at 4 o'clock Eastern on WABC in New York, and also Saturday mornings at 8. And WABC has an app. It is 77wabcradio.com or wabcradio.com. And so if you want to listen and give it a listen, we'd welcome you, and I thank you for mentioning that.
And I know you consider Walter Williams, the great economist, a mentor, but I have to ask, did you ever learn how many people it takes to create a pencil?
Yep, I did. And I'm not going to share the answer, because if I do it, it'll be like, oh, it was a trick question. It's not a trick question. Walter Williams was brilliant. He's one of the most brilliant people I have ever met in my life. Also one of the kindest people. I used to actually spend weekends occasionally, once or twice a year, at his house. He lived minutes away from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And he and his wife opened their doors to me, and Walter took the time to mentor me in economics. And that lesson was part of it. How many people does it take to build a pencil? And he gave me reading assignments and everything else. He was just an incredible man.
Well, this has been an incredible story, an incredible ride that you had with Rush, and you've now shared it all with us. The book is Rush on the Radio by James Golden, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly, a tribute from his sidekick for 30 years. James, just a fantastic book, and the podcast was great, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate the fact that you read the book. Thank you so much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.